I was really impacted by what Leroy shared last week. And I'm going to do a real quick summary of it because it was such an impactful thing to think about. And Leroy, if you can hear me and I don't tell it correctly, jump in here. I'm going to repeat a little of what you said last week. Or what? Maybe you go ahead and tell me.
About the...
Mm-hmm. Well, come up here and
I have to have it written down for me.
Well,
that's another thing. What it amounts to on the day before, 6th of June, 1944, the commander that, public relations guy, whatever he does, he gets up and addresses all the officers. And he tells them that the army, the higher ups, Eisenhower on up, is satisfied that they will probably have 100% casualty of all the men that go on the beach that day. The rest of the war will be taken over the guys that come up, but the ones that's headed out that day, They're expecting 100% casualty. Well, after that period, of course, the officers had to let all the rest of the men kind of know it. But according to the Cornelius Ryan, who writes the book, he said that the chaplains, the army there, had a field day. All these guys knew that they were heading off to the beach. And so they were all there for their last service that they would hear. And the two of the men that Ryan interviewed, one of them, his name was Schultz, and he said he went to see the Catholic priest, and the Catholic priest just gave him a riot act because of all the things he had confessed to him, particularly the Sixth Commandment. But the other fella, I forget his name right offhand, but he went to see the Protestant chaplain. The Protestant chaplain's name was Elder. Have any of you heard that name before? Good. I hope it wasn't Elder that he used as a kid growing up at his church. But anyway, his statement was, well, the fella went, he says, he wasn't a religious guy, but he thought he had better cover all the bases. So he goes into the big tent area where the chaplain is giving his last statements to the guys. He said, I got in, and I sat down on the last pew and the last seat that was even available. The place was crowded. And the chaplain elder says, now, the Lord is not particularly interested in those who come to Him in the time of need. With that, the fellow says, he must have seen me coming in. He got up and left. That was the last message all of those boys heard. And 9,000 of them died. No. 2,000
in the first hour. What a statement. The Lord's not particularly interested in those that coming in the hour of need. That just hit me last week, and I think the Lord is interested in us whenever and wherever we are. And I think that's been reverberating through my mind and my soul as I've thought about it all week, is how often we get caught in something having to be a certain way. Something having to be a certain orientation that fits with who we are, instead of understanding God. The title of the lesson today is The Cost of Discipleship. Let me see if I'm true. the cost of discipleship, and it's the last of these 13 weeks. And they at the end of on Friday, they quote Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and he wrote a book on the cost of discipleship. And here are some quotes from his book. But before we read these quotes, it's important to understand who Bonhoeffer is. He was a German theologian during the Nazi time. And he was one of the individuals who proclaimed and kept the focus on the evilness of Hitler and the atrocities that were occurring. And it's interesting in the fact that he went off and went to England and taught for a couple of years. He actually came to the United States and taught. But during the height of the conflict in Germany, he felt as if to stay in this place in the United States while my people are back there, he felt like he was betraying his people, and he also felt as if I can't be part of the reconstruction unless I'm part of the suffering. So his cost of discipleship is important to understand in light of context. That's what Rob always talks about, context. You know, sometimes we take the cost of discipleship into our world, but think about it from his perspective. You were shaking your head. You've heard about him. Tell me what you add to what I've said. Is there some other things?
You just...
What are some of the songs? I remember. Why don't you say that? Okay, but that's... That's fine. But that's another aspect. Absolutely. Right. And he was hung 2 weeks before the United States came and freed the camp that he was being held on. So, once again, context. His belief was that to say I'm a Christian and not be looking to empower the disenfranchised, to help others, was ludicrousy, was absurd. And what you can see, I mean, he was one of the ones responsible to help a lot of Jews get out of Germany. There was just, I mean, and I read just briefly about him. I mean, probably if we talked to Rob, he would have a much more broader understanding of him. But I wanted to add that context to this and then read some of these quotes. The old life is left behind and completely surrendered. The disciple is dragged out of his relative security into a life of absolute insecurity. That is, in truth, into absolute security and safety of the fellowship of Jesus. Now, that's an interesting thing. Think about his life again. We can take our life and say, okay, what am I sure? Should I sell all my things? Or, you know, we get caught in that. But his context of his words is dragged out of his relative security into a life of absolute insecurity. He could have stayed in New York, I think he was, or United States. But he believed he needed to go back there. He believed he needed to be back there in that place in Germany. But he said but the truth is, when you do that, you're into absolute security and the safety of fellowship of Jesus. The fellowship of Jesus. The person who commented, who was there at witnessing the execution, said that that was the most peaceful death he's ever seen. Dietrich prayed, walked up to the gallows. He was taken out there naked. walked up to the gallows, kneeled down in prayer, walked up, and died. Peaceful death you could ever imagine. That's what this one personalist quote is saying. Why? Absolute security and safety of the fellowship of Jesus. What does Ernie often say? If this is our home, if this is your home, if this is our home, oh, what a tragedy. This isn't our home. I mean, we talk about your sister. You talk about the grief and you say, why, God, did this person and not my sister? We don't know why. But this isn't our home. And that's such a powerful thing that we have to remember. You know, and then you think about it. What's the cost of discipleship? Oh, it's nothing. When you put it in the light of this, what he's saying, absolute security in Jesus. Next quote. If we follow Jesus, we must take certain definitive steps. The first step, which follows the call, cuts the disciple off from his previous existence. Now, what did Jesus say? Must be born again. You know, and then the question is, well, do you mean we're supposed to go and go into the birth canal and the womb and all that? You see how we didn't quite get it, those individuals. But Diedrich Bonhoeffer got it. We must be cut off from our previous existence. Now, once again, we have to take this in light of who he is, and then how does that apply to us? You know, does it mean we got to go out and live in the woods? Does it mean we got to go to Sudan? Or, you know, it means we have to recognize that Jesus, in relationship with Jesus, and what that means. If we would follow Jesus, we may... Oh, let me see the next one. The cross is laid on every Christian. The first Christ suffering which every man must experience is the call to abandon the attachments of this world. When Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. Now that's an interesting word. What does it mean, attachment of this world? What do you think it means, the attachments of this world?
When the things around us become the most important
things. The most important things. That's a good way to say the most important things. God is a jealous God. Is that because he's possessive? You're shaking your head. No, it's not, is it? It's because he knows in relationship to him, we are meant to be, and that's where the greatest freedom is. And I think that's such a powerful thing to keep the focus on is, but you know what? He's a jealous God who says, I'll let you decide. You know, when we think of the cost of discipleship, when you have, for any of you have children or grandchildren, is there anything they could do to stop your love for them? Not a thing. Why? It's what?
Unconditional.
Now, you may not have a relationship with them. They may be cut off from you and they may not choose to respond. But I'm talking about your experience. Now, but so it doesn't mean that the love is always going to be reciprocated, that the love is going to be activated. But the reality is, there is nothing that that child can do to cut themselves off from that love. That's why Ernie's talking about the good father or the prodigal son is such a powerful one. That son didn't feel it, but that father's would go and look every day. I thought it'd be interesting to look at this and reading some of this to look at 1 Corinthians 13. To look at what it means to understand the experience of love. Because when we talk about the cost of discipleship, sometimes we forget what the experience of a being integrated experience. Now, once again, let's go back to context. Paul was writing this to the Corinthians. What was happening at that time period? Same thing that happens with us. We start worrying about our position. We start thinking this should be a certain way. We start trying to figure out how to incorporate things that is a, we start looking at all the things in a, as a church body or as a people, and we start trying to figure out how do we do all this. You know, at the time period, there was a lot of posturing. There was a lot of people that were empowered versus the people that weren't empowered in the church, and how they were relating to one another. And the previous chapter 12, was all about the body. How every part of the body has an aspect that adds to the whole. And that every part contributes to the whole, and each part is greater because of the whole. And then he writes this chapter, Corinthians, verse 13. 1 Corinthians chapter 13. If I had the gift of speaking in any language, including the language of angels, but did not have love, I'd be like a noisy gong or a clanging cymbals. This is out of the clear word. If I had the gift of predicting the future and could understand all science and fathom all knowledge, or if I had some faith that I could move mountains but didn't have love, it would be worthless. If I gave everything I had to the church or used all my money to feed the poor, if I became a martyr by being burned to death for Christ but didn't have love, all such acts would count for nothing. You know, we've all heard this hundreds of times. But to think about what it really means. You know, where was that man that spoke those words to that individual if during that night before the D-Day? Where was that man's experience of understanding? Was he going to be out there in that front? Was he going to be part of that thousands that died in the first hour? He had lost touch with what the experience of humanity is. And I think that's what the discipleship is. Understanding. Your tears as you talked about the baby. The intense understanding of the suffering. But then the joy of that baby, just the resiliency, laugh, and she doesn't have a clue. Mercifully not. God's there. He's that girl is laughing. That's an important thing to understand. What does that mean? Love is patient and kind. It doesn't envy or boast, nor is puffed up with its own importance. Love is never rude, nor does it behave disorderly. It's not interested in itself, does not become angry or keep a record of wrongs. Carol and I once a month go and have lunch with her father, who it's been a very disconnected experience over her history and not really involved much in our lives. But, you know, we have a very limited experience, and we go and have lunch with him. He pays for our lunch, and then he gives money to Carol to give to Brendel and Farron. And as we were walking out last time, he said, he gave Carol the money. He said, tell the girls I loved him. Love them. And they said, whatever that means. What a profound statement, whatever that means. It probably has less meaning because he's not had the experience of being in a relationship with them. Whatever that means. Well, that's what Paul is saying here. Let me tell you what it means. Let me say exactly what it means. Does not think of itself. Patient. Does not envy. Not puffed up with its own importance. Wow. That's what it means. And when he said, whatever that means, I thought, wow, he doesn't realize what he just said. He doesn't realize that. And I think that's why he gives the money. Here they're, you know, 29 and 28, and one's a physician, one's going to graduate. They appreciate the money. They need the money. They're not, you know, they're... But yet, I think that's his way of saying, I can give you this. At her graduation, I guess, one of them... didn't he say at a graduation with her doctorate, he said to her, well, I'm not sure I contributed much to her except for child support. Once again, we get a little picture of his experience. And you know what? In a way, I appreciate his ability to be honest about it. But yet, he's the one that's experienced some loss. So Paul has given us a definition here. Love doesn't enjoy evil, but is always happy with truth. Doesn't enjoy evil. Bonhoeffer made sure he recognized it's about making sure you resist the evil. He actively did things to help people understand. And you know, all the things that were happening in Germany at that time where the churches were being taken over by people in charge, in the alliance with Hitler. I mean, there was just dynamics going on. He understood that. Love bears all things, believes all things, hope for all things, endures all things. Love will not fail. Love will not fail. One day prophecies will end, the gift of languages will cease, and our imperfect knowledge will vanish. We know so little, and prophecies give us only a glimpse of the future. But when the end comes, that which is imperfect will pass away. When I was a child, I spoke as a child, because I understood and thought as a child. But when I grew up, I put away childish ways of thinking behind me. Another way of saying, I left the old behind. I put away childish things. Think of what Bonhoeffer said, and then what Paul is saying. Now we see things obscurely as in a dark mirror, but then we will see things as they really are. Now I know God through His Word, but then I will know Him face to face, personally as He knows me. There are three important things that will last forever: faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. You know, we read these words, and once again, context. We can look in a mirror and we got a pretty good image coming out. Many times we don't like the image coming out, maybe. Maybe we want to do something about that image, but we can. But you got to remember, during that time period, they had just shiny metal that was not... They hardly gave him any kind of reflection back. But it was better than what they had. In this book, Anatomy of the Soul by Kurt Robinson, he comments... What? Kurt Thomas. Thank you. Keep me straight, mother. You always need a mother to keep you straight, don't you? And she lives with me, too. it's a book that Kevin told me about, and it's written by a psychiatrist, and he talks about the experience from a neurological standpoint, what the Christian experience is. And I thought it was just fascinating. And you know, the beauty is, not study a lot of neurological things, but he makes it very simplistic, and it's not written for a scientist. It's written for everybody. When we will also become fully mindful in the way that God is fully mindful of us. He talks about we will see Him face to face. In that day, when we are able to mentalize, sense, and discern in the way that Jesus does, our desires to understand mysteries and figure out the answers to all why questions will likely fade in the light of being known. Your why question. Why did God allow my father to sexually abuse me? Why did my child die? Why did I lose my job? Why did my marriage fail? People, and perhaps even you, have asked such questions down through the ages. But remember that why question is sometimes something we often ask when the emotional pain we're experiencing is too great to engage. And we often overwhelm precisely because of our limited awareness of a presence who is mindfully loving us. In that day, however, perfect mindfulness embodied in Jesus will swallow that pain in the joy and the beauty of the present moment of the new earth and the new heaven. Paul concludes the hymn of love by reminding us that all of life stands on three basic but unequal expressions: faith, hope, and love. This is consistent with the neuroscience and attachment tells us. All relationships, even at the most primitive level, must begin with faith, with trust, a basic building block for the structure, secure attachment. When we trust, we risk the possibility of rupture for the payoff of repair, and more deeply joyful integration between our minds. The idea of mindfulness, and we will be in an experience that will take all the why questions away. Absolutely. The why question is really an expression of your hurt and your pain and your desire to be connected to your sister and your loss. But at that moment, we will be in an experience where we are penetrated by knowing God and God knowing us. He goes on to say, faith, however, is never blind. In our mind, it never acts without first anticipating a particular outcome that we desire. As the writer of the New Testament letter to the Hebrews suggests, faith is being sure of what we hope for. That's an interesting thing. Faith is being assured of what we hope for, not of what we already have. Hope energizes and draws trust into motion into the future. We anticipate becoming more than we are. If our appetite for such things was anorexic, we would have no impetus for trust. Hope is that appetite. But neither hope nor faith has a pulse in the absence of love. Only love perfectly mentalizes. And when he say perfectly mentalizes, he means understanding we can be known and we know somebody else. Only love, clothed in the light of perfect coherent narrative, approaches another with mindfulness that fears nothing, ignores shame, and repairs the ultimate rupture in Jesus' death and resurrection. Only love can create the context in which faith or hope is born and sustained. In the new heaven/earth realm, the need for faith or hope is unlikely, for both are dependent on future states. Love is about the present moment. About the present moment. It's about what's happening right now. Faith, hope, there's something that's moving us forward. But all that will be gone away when we're in the presence and the mindfulness of Jesus. And you know, that's kind of what I like about his thoughts, is this begins now. And Paul alludes to it. We see darkly, but we have something. When you see that child laugh, you have hope and faith. Because you see that child in the midst of all this, sitting there laughing. But yet you're ready for that fullness when there won't have to be darkly. You're ready for the fullness of one-on-one mindfulness. But it begins now. It begins when you relate to those parents. It begins when you're with that child. Something happens to you. You like what happens to you when you go and you do these things. It's distressing on the family. It causes, you know, all kinds of things. But something happens to you because you're responding. When we respond, something happens to us. Something happens to us. We have been called to embody all the virtues listed in 1 Corinthians 13. But without love, we cannot do so. So I suggest that the path to developing such love includes the process of being known. You talked about missing for 2 weeks. What did you miss? Coming and feeling known. Coming and having the experience of interacting with others. Sharing your burden. Sharing your frustration and wondering what the tears were about. That you being known. It's the experience of feeling felt. You feel understood. You feel felt. You have a sense that somebody gets you. The encounter of being validated but never coddled. I like that. Validated but never coddled. Being cared for but not overwhelmed or patronized. Being fully understood while calling in the proper risk-taking adventure. Being healed and awakened to growth, compassion, and responsibility. Furthermore, this process requires us to live in close proximity to one another, becoming a body that breathes justice and mercy, and requires the presence of love, which then doubles back its full development and depending on that very community. Ultimately, this cycle is empowered by the Holy Spirit, who creates all of this through the process of being known. I think that's the powerful thing that we all offer to each other, is to be known. Carol has this little new car that I went to Florida and bought, or we bought, and I went and picked it up. And she told me the other day, she said, "You know why I love this car? It does everything that my body's never been able to do. It's quick, it's responsive, it's agile, it's this," and she started describing all these things that this car does. It's a little sports car, S2000 Honda. And she has a Z4 that we're selling, but it was fast but kind of sloppy. It didn't hug the road. It kind of like you'd have to really kind of keep it on there. And you go to turn and you have to, you know. But this car that she had one before, and it does. And I thought, what a beautiful experience for her to realize why I love this car. It's all the things in my body. In Carol's workout room, she has this little cartoon, and it's this stick figure, and it says, "I think I need to be redrawn." And what is, we all need to be redrawn. And when's that going to take place? When we're in the presence of God. We're going to be redrawn, reconfigured, anew. Yes, I needed a new chassis. I told her that. I need a new chassis. She told me, "When you find a good used one, let me know." I said, "I don't want a used one. I want to go for a new one." finally, this author says, Paul's vision of community is that of a complex system. Though he doesn't, of course, use this term, a system that thrives in the oscillating balance between the rigidity of sameness and the chaos of mental bedlam, both within and between the minds. Now, the rigidity of sameness. We need sameness. We come here a certain time. We plan on that. But we cannot make that our God. So the chaos of mental bedlam, both within and between minds. In such a community of intimacy, a community of integrated prefrontal cortexes, members are quick to honor and protect those who are vulnerable. In our world that include those who trapped on the lower end of society power gradient, including the poor, the elderly, and those of different ethnicity, culture, or sexual orientation. In such a community, members also confidently and kindly set limits on behavior that undermines the group's integration and differentiation. There's a lot of stuff right there. Coherently and kindly sets limits on behavior that undermines the group integration and differentiation. A lot of what I do as a therapist, I work with these foster kids, and they have no limits. And it's frightening because they're scared. But they will resist everything about any limit. This one girl, when she insisted that the foster parent take her to get Dairy Queen, and when she didn't, she got her and a 10-year-old and a 7-year-old sister and a 6-year-old foster girl, and they just walked away. They were going to walk. This is out in Keene. And this kid was just walking. And she wanted to have what she wanted at that moment and didn't want to have no. That's going back to that basic reptilian brain that just is going to get whatever you need. But there's fear in that. The cost of discipleship is really a relationship with Jesus. And in that, there is the greatest freedom there ever could be. And in that day when we see face to face, there'll be no questions asked. We won't have to ask why, because we'll be known and we will know. I look forward to that day. Shall we pray? Dear God, we're so grateful we can come together and remind ourselves of how much you love us and how much you care. And we often get caught in moments and think about what we should do or what we ought to do instead of realizing what we want to do in relationship to you. May that relationship become so important that there's nothing will stop us, that nothing will get in its way, that we will then recognize that you are our Savior and you desire for us to be with you eternally. May each one of us experience that in our daily lives. In your holy name, amen. I want to tell you the quick story I forgot. I don't know if any of you saw this piece of ice, these two kids caught on this ice that was floating toward this dam. It was on the news this last week, I think Monday. Well, these two kids, come up here, James. These two kids are out on this ice and they're huddled like this. And the ice is floating away. And these kids were playing along the bank and they apparently one kid threw their shoe out there and they went to get the shoe. And then this piece of ice broke away. The mother's standing on the bank and she says, "You're not in trouble. You're not in trouble." And I'm thinking, these kids are huddling there. I am in trouble. I am in trouble. But you know what the mother was trying to convey is, I'm not mad at you. And I think about with that with God is, he says, you're not in trouble. But unlike this woman, God is out there bridging the gap. I wanted to share that. Have a great Sabbath day.